Listen to another parable. There was a landowner who planted a vineyard, put a fence around it, dug a wine press on it, and built a watchtower. Then he leased it to tenants and went to another country. When the harvest time had come, he sent his slaves to the tenants to collect his produce. But the tenants seized his slaves and beat one, killed another, and stoned another. Again, he sent other slaves, more than the first, and they treated them in the same way. Finally, he sent his son to them, saying, "They will respect my son." But when the tenants saw the son, they said to themselves, "This is the heir. Come, let us kill him and get his inheritance." So they seized him, threw him out of the vineyard, and killed him. Now when the owner of the vineyard comes, what will he do to those tenants? They said to him, "He will put those wretches to a miserable death and lease the vineyard to other tenants who will give him the produce at the harvest time." The word of the Lord.
So it's a little difficult to dive right into our story this morning of King David and the prophet Nathan without providing a little or maybe a lot of context. As you know, we've been working our way through the narrative lectionary this fall, which begins with these Old Testament stories that we don't often encounter, at least here when we focus a lot on the Gospels. We've heard the story this fall of Noah and the flood, the call of Abraham and Sarah to pack up and leave their home, of Joseph being sold into slavery by his brothers. We read the story of how God then liberated the people from their slavery in Egypt and then set up the commandments to guide their life together, the structures of freedom. And last week, Dave preached about how the Israelites once again were turning to other gods and Joshua called them back. Through it all, we have seen how over and over again, God somehow makes a way out of no way. And I think today's story is no different. At this point in the story, the elders of Israel have gathered together and told Samuel, the judge who was charged with overseeing Israel, that they wanted to be led by a king. They were tired of this system of judges. They wanted to just be like all of the other nations. They wanted a king. Samuel prayed to God because he didn't like this idea at all. And perhaps one of the more heartbreaking texts, God's response to Samuel saying this: "Listen to the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. Just as they have done to me from the day I brought them out of Egypt to this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so also they are doing to you. Now then, listen to their voice. Only you shall warn them and show them the ways of the king who shall reign over them." And so, having been warned that the kings will not rule the people with such grace and justice as God, perhaps foreshadowing stories like today's, Israel still demanded they be led by a king. And so God, through Samuel, anointed Saul as king over Israel. And if you read that story, you know that it does not go well. It ends badly. Which leads to David, the character in our story today, being anointed the king. And he's often talked about, oddly, in light of today's story, as one of the better, if not the best, kings out of all of Israel's kings. But the story we encounter today is difficult at best. It's probably a familiar story, and it begins with King David out, as we heard, out on the terrace in his palace late one night, overlooking the city and seeing Bathsheba bathing in the moonlight down below. And then perhaps in an all too familiar pattern, he abuses his power and his status and his position. And now Bathsheba is pregnant. So David has her husband Uriah killed out on the battlefield and then takes Bathsheba as his wife. But enter the prophet Nathan with the story of a rich man who, instead of using one of his own animals for a feast, of which he had many, he steals the lamb of a very poor family, a lamb that was like a daughter to this poor man, and the rich man takes it to use as part of the feast. David is outraged. How can this be? And says that that man should die. Nathan, in perhaps one of the gutsier truth to power kinds of moments, says to the king, "You are that man." Let us pray. Holy and gracious God, we come into this place to worship, to sing your praises, to hear your word, to feast at your table, perhaps to encounter some honesty and truth and be led into growth and new life. With all of the things on our minds, the lists, the tasks, the stuff that has to get done, we bid you come and still our hearts, that we might hear a word of good news. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be pleasing to you, Lord our God, our rock and our redeemer. Amen. So when I was probably about 12, and I do have a little hesitation telling this story, but here we go. Oh, but before I do, you need to know that when I'm going to reference silver, and when I reference that, I'm talking about my parents' silver, like their dishes and their serving dishes and silverware, the good stuff that you pull out when you have company over, special occasions. So when I was like 11 or 12, my sister, who was 4 years older than me, was at that age when she was spending a lot of time on the phone. And unlike today, for some of you who need to know this, unlike today, in those days, you only had one phone line that came into your house. And I was desperately, talking about feeling old, I was desperately waiting for a call from her friend so I could go and play. But my sister refused to get off the phone. And this was becoming an ongoing pattern in our relationship and family. And at this point, I had had enough. And to be honest, it's here that I kind of want to add something about how maybe I was having a bad day. Or my sister was particularly smug this day about being on the phone. But I think that those are maybe just very subtle attempts at some self-deception. Because it's difficult to just be honest and say, yeah, I lost a little bit of control. Because the truth is, after my sister refused to get off the phone, I went downstairs. And on my way down the stairs into our family room, in my anger and my frustration, I punched the wall over top, and it cracked the plaster. And then after I was all the way down, I proceeded to kick a wall. And it's at this point that everything sort of goes into slow motion. Have you ever had one of these moments where everything kind of goes into slow motion? And I noticed that when I kicked the wall, my foot was going through the drywall and then back out again, leaving this huge hole. I immediately snapped out of my anger and my frustration and went into panic mode. I cleaned up a little bit and I tried to put the pieces of the drywall back in their place as if to make it appear as if nothing had happened. And then I went upstairs, pretending everything's fine. But a half hour later, my dad calls up the stairs saying, "Aaron, can you come down here?" My heart sank. I slowly made my way down the stairs, and there are my mom and my dad, surprisingly calm, I thought. "Aaron, do you know what happened here?" "Huh, that's strange. No, I have no idea. I don't know what happened here. I mean, I did kick my soccer ball down the stairs, and maybe it bounced and hit the wall here. I don't know." Never mind the fact that in order for this to actually be something that could happen, it would have to defy both the laws of gravity and physics because of where the wall was positioned. "Aaron, I don't see how that could have been the cause of this hole." And of course, I now know at this point that my parents are very much aware that I am the perpetrator. But I was getting desperate. And I really just wanted to get out of there. I didn't want to have to be honest about how this had happened, because it meant admitting to myself that I had the capacity to do something like this. And of course, at that age, I also didn't want to have to face the consequences of my behavior. And it's such an uncomfortable moment, and I so desperately want to get out there, so I say this. I don't know. Maybe someone broke into our house and kicked a hole in the wall. I should go upstairs and check the silver and make sure they didn't steal it. And so I ran up the stairs, safe. I'm not as clear about what happened after this. And I think that probably my parents, as I now understand as a parent, were probably laughing enough that they didn't punish me as much as they probably could have or maybe should have. But what I know to this day is that every time we in our family something happens and no one really wants to own up to it, someone will inevitably say, oh, someone better check the silver. But you see, in that moment, when confronted with what I had done, I immediately went into this sort of self-protection mode, as if my ego was desperately trying to protect itself, not only from any incoming external consequences, but I also think from having to acknowledge something about myself. I mean, most of us don't want to think of ourselves as people who could do something bad. And so we work hard to avoid having to consider that possibility. In some ways, it's the ego's move of self-protection, of navigating and avoiding the fear and anxiety that comes with it. And perhaps it's important to be a little bit more nuanced. It's not so much that we don't want to see ourselves as bad people. That's obviously pretty simplistic. I think it's more that we have a great discomfort with being honest about who we sometimes can be or who we sometimes are. There's a pastor up in Wisconsin who put it this way. We exhibit an amazing agility in avoiding the truth about who we are and what we do. Our failures in being honest with ourselves are instances of self-deception. And if at this point you're thinking to yourself, oh, I'm so glad I came this morning for a sermon on self-deception, you're not alone. But the truth of the gospel is that it can't be avoided. There are moments and seasons when we deceive ourselves into thinking that something we've done doesn't really defy our values. That thing I did is fine because, and the self-deception begins. But what exactly is self-deception? Put simply, self-deception is when we convince ourselves that what we are doing doesn't violate any of the values or morals we are committed to. And none of us are immune to it. But it doesn't just happen with individuals. It can happen with institutions and governments and organizations and, yes, even churches and denominations. We convince ourselves that our words and actions are not out of step with our commitments. I think we are seeing this a lot today in the church and in our political discourse. And so often what betrays this self-deception are the denials, the rationalizations, the justifications, the finger-pointing, the evasion of responsibility, all signs that point to those moments when, intentionally or not, we are deceiving ourselves and, in turn, our community. Psychologist James Hollis talks about it as our attempts to avoid those conflicts, the interior and exterior conflicts, when our ego's idea of who we are doesn't align with who we actually are. And instead of choosing the more difficult path of growth and transformation, we so often revert to that easier path that ultimately diminishes us. It's one of the reasons that Carl Jung once said that we are all walking around in shoes too small. This difficult story of how David assaulted Bathsheba and then had her husband Uriah the Hittite killed so Bathsheba could be his wife and he could cover up the story is a story about how David had deceived himself into believing that this abuse of power and status were somehow not antithetical to the commandments of God. Or at best, he was afraid of those external and internal consequences of his behavior if it got out. It's a story about how David chose to seek his own good at the expense of his neighbors. And in that way, this is a story about our ability to deceive ourselves and how hard we sometimes work to maintain the ego's sense of self at our own expense and our neighbors. There are more than a few stark moments in this story, all worthy of exploration. But there's a couple that I want to highlight in particular. There's that moment when Bathsheba comes to David and says four words in the English translation. Three words, sorry. I am pregnant. It is such a short phrase, a few words, but these words plunge David into what Hollis calls the swamplands of the soul. Those places where we are invited to see how our ego's agenda of control and comfort and order and reinforcement and security limit our humanity. The swamplands are those uncomfortable spaces where something or someone creates a space where the rigor and depth of questions raised jar us out of complacency, out of the casual reiterations of untroubled life, and bring us to the daily dilemma of choosing something that enlarges us or something that diminishes us. Bathsheba's words, "I am pregnant," are a swampland kind of moment for David. They present to him a choice. Do I choose a path that will enlarge me, make me larger, grow, transformation, or a path that will diminish me and continue a pattern? Unfortunately, instead of sitting with these more difficult questions, moving toward growth, an uncomfortable task, no doubt, something that demands more of us than we often wish to provide, David moves to protect and maintain the status quo, which is always a move that diminishes. And so he tries to convince Uriah to sleep with his wife, thus providing a reason why Bathsheba might be pregnant. And when that fails, David has Uriah killed out on the battlefield. But then comes the next dark phrase. As I said, in one of those more amazing moments of the story, the prophet Nathan tells that story of a wealthy man who stole and slaughtered the lamb instead of using his own, which he had many. And when David is enraged at the injustice, "That man should die," Nathan says, "You are that man." Another stark, short phrase. And another invitation. Another invitation for David to investigate and navigate those swamplands of the soul in a way that would summon him to something more. And here, David responds very differently. He doesn't cast Nathan out or have him killed in an attempt to kind of continue the deception, both internal and external, in order to avoid that more difficult work. But he hears the truth and is honest about himself. He confesses, "Create in me a clean heart, O God." When his self-deception collides with this summons from Nathan, he accepts the invitation and confesses the ways he has turned from God at the expense of his neighbors, doing damage to himself along the way. And I have no doubt that this moment and each of these stark moments felt a whole lot like death to David. One of those little kinds of deaths, because it was a dying to self. Quite literally, a dying to self. The more difficult move that we are invited to make towards wholeness and life. No doubt when you spend time in the details of the story, it can be difficult to see where the good news in this terrible series of events is. Amidst the abuse of power and position and all of the violent consequences of trying to avoid the summons of those swamplands of the soul, the good news seems in short supply, especially for Bathsheba and Uriah. And justice seems to never come for either of them. I think it's important to name that. But even still, I do think there is some good news, even in the midst of the challenge and suffering in a story like this. And I think the good news is the buoyancy of God's grace and God's commitment to summon us to something more. Even in spite of all David has done, in spite of his self-deception and avoidance, God continues to summon David into that more difficult but more honest work that is the seedbed of his transformation and growth into wholeness and life. To be sure, like my 12-year-old self so many years ago, who desperately wanted to blame the hole in the wall on a thief, better check the silver. We all have a tendency to avoid and deceive ourselves and others in one way or another. And I think there are many times we find ourselves in those swamplands of the soul. Whatever causes that encounter, we find ourselves with a summons to more, with an opportunity to choose growth or diminishment. And the good news is that God is faithful and continues to pursue us, and sometimes even in spite of us, God continues to summon us to something more. Because God knows that life springs from death. Not only, Barbara Brown Taylor put it, not only at the last, but also in the many little deaths along the way. Life springs from death. John Newton, who wrote that much beloved hymn, Amazing Grace, lived in the 18th century and was very involved in the slave trade. He was the first mate on a ship that would bring goods to West Africa and trade them for slaves who would then be transported across the ocean in the most brutal of conditions and sold into slavery in the new colonies. And despite a conversion to Christianity in 1748, Newton continued to trade and transport slaves. However, perhaps having had one of those swampland kinds of moments, he would later say of this first conversion and continued participation in the slave trade, "I cannot consider myself to have been a believer in the full sense of the word until sometime later." He exited or retired from the slave trade over, it feels weird to talk about retiring from the slave trade, over 30 years later and studied to become an Anglican priest. And it wasn't until 1788 that he publicly renounced slavery when he wrote and sold a pamphlet entitled Thoughts on the Slave Trade. And it's here that he wrote about how this is a confession which comes too late. My participation in the slave trade will always be a subject of humiliating reflection to me. That I was once an active instrument in a business at which my heart now shudders. About 10 years before this pamphlet was published, Newton wrote the hymn, Amazing Grace. And it's based on King David. It's based on King David's response of amazement that God would make a lasting covenant with him. Reflecting on King David's life and his many failings, Newton was overwhelmed at the grace shown to himself as well. Someone who also avoided the summons of those swampland visitations. Someone who also lived in self-deception. Someone who, in spite of his faith, continued to participate in one of the most brutal of businesses. It's in response to this that he penned this swamplands of the soul visitation, that he penned Amazing Grace. And I'll be honest, I sometimes struggle with the language that saved a wretch like me. It always feels a little harsh to me. But it's really helpful to consider it in the context of him doing the difficult and courageous work of being honest about what he had done. Wretched acts. And of course, it's followed by the words, "I once was lost, but now am found. Was blind, but now I see. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound." That's the invitation of those difficult swampland visitations. The summons to more, wholeness and life. Amazing grace indeed. Thanks be to God.